Hello, and welcome to this special live edition of The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. It's me, your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined live in the studio in Bruegel's headquarters with Simone Tagliapetra, our director, German Sattelmeier, Reinhilde Vergelers. We are going to walk through the economic part of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's State of the European Union speech this morning to the EU Parliament. If you want to ask us questions, we have a Slido code. It is State of Union with no spaces. We hope you will contribute. And with that, we're going to jump right into it. Chairman, what did you make of President von der Leyen's speech this morning, and what can we expect for the rest of her term?
So I thought it was a pretty strong speech in the circumstances. And by the circumstances, I mean a position in which the EU has just been humiliated by the United States, in which the international order is clearly shifting against the EU. The benevolent hegemon is no longer benevolent. The rules-based trade is crumbling, which we depend on because we are an expensive continent that depends on being able to import intermediate products, raw materials, and then export them. And of course, we are not a militarily strong power, and so we depend on international law. And so the question was, you know, it is hard to come to anything but the conclusion that Europe is in a terrible position. Now, normally, State of the Union speeches are supposed to be about the State of the Union is strong. So the question was, how is she going to square that circle? And, you know, my expectation was that she would square the circle largely by putting a brave face on things, but she did go a significant step further. She, to some degree, tackled with the bull by the horns. So she started exactly with the types of things I've just said, by recognizing that Europe is in a pickle, that our future is in danger, and that security and dependencies, including with respect to the United States, are a key part of the problem. And the fact that she did recognize this, I think I give her very high marks on that. Then there's a question, and we will talk about that, of whether that was then followed up by substance, by ideas on how to respond to that. And there I have mixed feelings, and others, my colleagues, will talk about that. Just one more word. She also tackled the bull by the horns, though, you know, maybe a little less convincingly, and buried somewhere in the middle of the speech. I think it came right after the farmers or something like that, by actually trying to defend the Turnberry deal. And, you know, she defended it without resorting to the ultimate argument that, you know, this was an extortion because we are militarily weak and dependent on the United States, which I believe is probably the real reason. She defended it on the economic merits by saying, first, reminding everyone that we are very export dependent on the United States, and second, that we got a relatively good deal, which is true. So while, you know, everyone pretty much got screwed, we got screwed, you know, maybe a little less than the others. So in relative terms, it may strengthen our position in the United States compared to other exporters there. And then she went out of her way to put down a red line, which is regulatory autonomy. Now, it begs the question, though, that if we are willing to accept this deal because, as she said it, she does not gamble with European livelihoods or something like that, right? The overwhelming importance, economic importance of the U.S., what makes us so sure that she will actually defend that red line? Because with the same argument, you could say, you know, this relationship is too important on trade to actually gamble with people's lives. So yeah, let's make some compromises on regulation as well. So that was a little bit weaker. It was just an assertion. But on the whole, I thought she dealt with the challenge remarkably well. She reset the tone. I think she regained her footing.
Simone, you have been covering the Green Deal since it was a glimmer in the Commission's eye. Where does it stand after this speech and in general?
Thank you, Rebecca. I also wanted to follow up to what Jeremy just said to say that also in my view, the speech has been pretty bold. It has been pretty bold for at least four reasons. The first is that the president recognized very clearly that Europe is in unprecedented fight for its independence, values, and democracy. And I think this recognition is the necessary starting point, no? For any conversation about what needs to happen next. Second, I think, unlike maybe in the past years, she has really showed unprecedented responsiveness to many concerns of European citizens, spanning from the situation in Gaza to the housing crisis and the cost of living pressures, including from high energy prices. Third, I think she importantly recognized that nostalgia is not a strategy, and that Europe must fight for its values. And finally, and that's, I think, the important question here, she put forward the fundamental question of, does Europe have the stomach to fight? And I think this is something we need to face, because so far is the answer to this question is unclear. Is unclear on the member states' side, because too often we see the member states opposing further integration. It's unclear on the European Parliament side, which is often, as we have also seen today, very divided. But often it is also unclear on the president herself side, right? Because too often we have gotten in the past the impression that instead of driving an agenda, she has been often looking for the lowest common denominator between the member states in order to try to establish consensus. So I think what she's implying with this speech is the need for a step change in the way we govern the Union. And I think that's the major point out of this speech to start with.
Reinhilde.
Yep. So I also agree that the talk was really good in terms of recognizing the diagnosis that we need to be bold and that we could be bold here. But the question is, what do we need to do in order to be bold here? And I was actually a bit disappointed in the extent to which she put really competitiveness and innovation capacity at the core in terms of how to be bold here. I was also a bit struck by what one of the parliament members said. He said, stop talking about the EU as a market, see the EU as a power, but that actually doesn't really see that if Europe really wants to have power in these geopolitical games, it should really have its economic power and military power here and use that very cleverly diplomatically, of course. But that economic and military power really depends on, do we have the technology capacity to really supply what we need in order to be sufficiently independent here? And I was really missing the extent to which we are really concretely bold enough in terms of building that innovation capacity. This has been a problem since a long time here. Draghi made it very clear, but we know that already since a long time. We've tried already several of these things, and nothing has really worked sufficiently. So I'm not sure that whatever we're proposing in terms of the new competitiveness fund, the Choose Europe, that will really be sufficiently bold in order to really change that innovation capacity. So I was a bit disappointed in seeing more on that front.
Jeremy, it sounded like you thought she came into this speech in a pretty weak position and yet gave a pretty decent speech. Is that fair? Does that give us any clue for how she can make something better out of a bad hand going forward?
Well, I think the speech gives me some reassurance that we are likely to take a more focused and a more committed position in the future on points that are critical, just because the speech has some commitment value. For example, when she defended regulatory autonomy, when she was very strong on Ukraine and when she was, you know, openly recognizing that we do have tensions with the United States. So I think this is a good beginning. The real question then is, well, two things. One is it's about the substance. So what are the actual policies that will achieve that? But the other point, and here I wanted to follow up to something that Simone said, is about this willingness to fight. And so here, like Simone said, you know, generally, this commission, and by that I mean the second von der Leyen commission, not the first. The first von der Leyen commission was very willing to fight. The second von der Leyen commission in its first years has not been very willing to fight. It is not fought for a larger budget, except to a relatively small degree. The omnibus package was, certainly omnibus one, was rushed, and you can interpret this as an unwillingness to fight with industry and tell them, look, we want to fix the regulation rather than simply set it aside. And finally, there was most definitely no willingness to fight with member states over, you know, money, but also about coordination of policies, about a more coherent and assertive approach to trade policy. And so, you know, in some sense, the speech really contradicts the impression I got from the president in the first 12 months, which is that this is a president who is systematically avoiding fights with member states, with the United States, with industry. And now she comes and says, we all have to learn how to fight. So pardon me says she has a credibility problem. Pardon me says maybe she's learned something. Maybe she actually felt bad about the whole Scotland experience. Maybe she feels bad about the humiliation that she suffered. Maybe the criticisms, which are very harsh, have led to some kind of reaction. And I'm sort of, like I said, I like the speech. I sort of buy the beginning. And so I'm giving her a bit of credit for that, that she might actually have drawn some lessons. Now, one sense in which I would be critical of the speech is that she did not go far enough then in, you know, re-emphasizing or redefining policies that are consistent with that different approach. So, for example, she could have said, look, obviously she cannot now go and ask for a different budget, MFF, than the one that the commission just asked for pre-Turnbury. Right. So to some extent, there is a problem which has to do just with the policymaking process that, you know, policies are always a moving average of concerns of the past, concerns of the present, concerns of the future. And for the most part, the work agenda of the commission comes out of the Draghi report, which in turn is largely a reaction to the economic policies of President Biden, not all those of President Trump. So it comes out of a different era, and it has only been gradually and expanded into the strategic autonomy direction. And so she cannot completely flip out of the agenda that's going on at this point. But she could have emphasized some parts more. And one of those things could be to defy member states a little bit. I would have wanted stronger rhetoric on member states who are torpedoing the single market agenda, who are opposing energy union, who are telling her no, even to her extremely modest request for just a somewhat larger budget. And so had she had some examples of actually fighting in that speech, rather than just calling in the abstract for more fighting, I would have found her more convincing.
I agree. And if I may add to this, at a certain point of the speech, she said that the union has demonstrated its capability to deliver in emergencies. And it needs to demonstrate its capability to deliver in more ordinary times, which is exactly what Draghi said in Rimini a few weeks ago in a very strong call for action that, not by coincidence, I think was also recalled by Weber during the debate. So I think that is exactly where we are. The need to move from strategic planning to action. She made a very specific reference to this need while talking about the clean industrial deal. I think the president recognized that for now, with all the clean industrial deal work that has been done, we have basically identified the bottlenecks and we have started to plan the strategy. But we really do not see yet any action undertaken in Brussels that can really mobilize €1 of green investments out there. That's the reality, in my view. We still need to see tangible policies, so moving from communications to regulations that can really spark the clean tech investment wave of the industrial decarbonization wave we want to see. And I think she said it's now high time for implementation. And I very much agree with that. I think many MEPs during the debate also said we need to move from strategy to implementation. And there is, I hope, with this speech, a new sense of urgency to move in that direction.
And Hilda, where does industrial policy fit into this?
Yeah, so really showing that you're serious about fighting is really very important. For the Clean Deal, what really made a big difference, I think, is that we've set very clear targets in terms of climate change that we wanted to address here. And that really helped also, and committing to those targets really also helps very much to alleviate private investment bottlenecks here. I think we should learn from that more generally, because the innovation gap that we're facing also holds in other sectors here. And also for that, if we really want to show our willingness to fight, we should really also, again, commit to very clear targets, not just only in terms of how much we want to spend with public investment, but also how much do we want to leverage private investments as well, and have very clear KPIs that we want to commit to that from the start. And we monitor and evaluate whether whatever we are doing will actually work in terms of these KPIs. Then at least you show, I think, a bit more seriously that you're willing to fight and what it takes to fight also, and commit to that. And on top of that, if you have very clear targets to which you stick to, this will also create enough certainty, or at least remove the uncertainty, to unleash the private investments that we would need, which is the basic problem that we're facing in Europe. It's not public investment, it's the private investment that we need to leverage.
And KPI is, of course, a key performance indicator.
Yes.
We have questions from online. The first two that have come in, and we are hashtag State of Union. We have a question about the local dimension, which is to say, can the EU encourage local policies, maybe through this housing initiative that she mentioned or other things like that? And the other question is, what are a couple of tough but important reforms that member states need to make for productivity to grow across the EU? Chairman.
So on the housing issue, there is, so fundamentally, this is not in a commission competency, so it is difficult. But first, I give her high marks for actually pushing this. It is one of the things that were generally new about the speech, and very important, because it is truly a shared concern across virtually all European countries. Now, the one thing that possibly the EU can do is, and she mentioned that, is on permitting, trying to set common standards, right? So it is something where, whether it takes the form of a directive, so legal coordination, or simply prodding members to agree on a common standard. I think in its broad coordination function, the EU and certainly the Commission can probably push. What was the second point on? Reforms. Well, so I do believe that apart from coordinating better, the productivity agenda has to be carried forward through transformational reforms at the national level. And obviously the most important thing is that the big countries get in front of this. Now, France has tried and often failed in the last few years, and it is in a terrible political situation. Germany is in a position where, this is supposed to be a reformist government, and the question is now whether it can deliver on the big challenges. The biggest one, I think, would be pension reform and entitlement reform, where Germany is prototypical for it. You know, essentially, it suffers from a democratic problem, and whether it can turn this deform into a strength by putting its pension system further on a fully funded, or if not fully funded, privately capital market-based basis, which would then feed into the savings investment union agenda. So there's basically the big question in the room is, if a country like Sweden and Denmark could do it, why can Germany not do it? And if Germany did it, that would be completely transformational just because of the sheer size. The proximate answer to my question is, it's much harder for demographic reasons to do it now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. But this is not a problem that money cannot solve, and this would be worth spending money on one time, right? So this is something that I think should be coming. The other area, of course, is on regulation, which is on over-regulation, which is a common problem, and Germany is trying to do something about it. We shall see.
So in terms of productivity growth, I think what's really very important is the uptake of new technologies, and particularly AI technologies will be super important here. And I think there we really need to think about how to make sure that there are enough incentives for the uptake of these new technologies here. And then the fragmented market of the EU is very important. So the single market agenda, I think, is really important on all dimensions in order to be able to access financing, and particularly risk financing, but also skills, attracting skills and attracting clients and services. But I think what's really also important is having an open, competitive single market here. And that means that we also need to have sufficiently new companies being able to challenge. And that's why, for me, the 28 regime, we like to call it the zeroth regime here, I think will be very important, because that will actually also allow young companies to take on board these new technologies on a larger scale enough, soon enough to be competitive, and therefore challenge the others as well. So for me, the zeroth regime is also a very good example of how we can actually push forward further the single market here in a way to increase productivity growth.
Let me ask you about cars, the European industry of the past and possibly the present, and according to President von der Leyen, maybe the future. What do you make of her commitment to build a small, affordable European electric vehicle to compete with the Chinese?
I think what we need to make sure is that there is enough incentives for companies to supply if there is enough big enough market here. So I'm not sure what we would need from a public policy support to build that project here. It's not a kind of same kind of example as a moonshot here. I think it just means creating or removing the barriers for a competitive market to be able to deliver, because that will be the largest market in future, is the electric vehicle markets for a large audience that you can export also to other countries here. There should be enough private incentives for companies to be able to do that here. So I'm not sure how that should be something that we should need to do together with some of the incumbent car producers.
Maybe to complement this point, she also announced, no, in tandem with this idea of the European e-car, small e-car, the proposal, no, the announcement about the battery booster package. Now, these are the kind of proposals that sound very good on paper, but the impact and the effectiveness of such proposals is to be seen, right? Because if you look at what she put forward on that, is a package of 1.8 billion for equity to boost production of batteries in Europe. But then the question is this the real bottleneck we are encountering here when it comes to battery manufacturing? She, of course, didn't mention the failure of Northvolt, but I think we cannot develop a smart industrial policy for batteries in Europe without a careful assessment of what went wrong with Northvolt. The problem of Northvolt was certainly not the funding. Northvolt was the better funded startup in Europe, funding from the EIB, from the Commission itself, from the German government, and still it went bankrupt for a number of reasons spanning from the persistent reliance on foreign suppliers, and namely the Chinese for the machineries, on the critical inputs, the challenge of managing a very quick scale-up phase, right? So with all the managerial problems attached to that. And of course, the problem of competing with the Asians, and namely with the Chinese peers. So the problem is way broader and deeper than just throwing 1.8 billion there, right? So I think we really need to take a bit of a step back here. There are other stories we might need to reassess, I think, of green hydrogen, for example, to really better identify how to target the industrial policy actions of the coming months, because we need to learn from these failures we had recently in Europe. Otherwise, we are not moving in the right direction.
And that's definitely not her strength and not the strength of this commission. Right, so this commission is not about identifying trade-offs and picking its battles. It's about essentially wanting more of everything in a very broad way, and ultimately we know that it cannot work. But here, I think there is a failure to go further, and partly this is inherent in the problem that it's harder to pick one's battles these days than traditionally, right? Because usually, what it means picking your battles is you go for your areas of comparative advantage, but that in turn can then generate dependencies in other areas. So I sympathize with the commission trying to solve a very big problem. I don't see them, though, as actually facing up to that, to the problem in a serious way. This is not so much a critique of the speech, which cannot solve everything, as a critique of the commission work program in areas, for example, like trying to protect energy-intensive industry in a completely blanket way, where, you know, just because you're energy-intensive, you're worth protecting. That's essentially what the state aid rules, the reforms say. Okay, you also have to do some investments in climate, but there's no attempt to reconcile this with a productivity agenda, which would say you cannot protect everyone, even if they do good things in climate, right? So the failure to tackle that is rather fundamental.
Can I maybe just add another trade-off that probably needs a more careful assessment? When Draghi, in the report, tackled the clean tech issue, he said you need a granular industrial policy. You need to look into the individual supply chains and identify where are the comparative advantages that Europe has in these technologies. There are technologies that where we don't have comparative advantages, so we just need to keep importing cheap technologies for the sake of accelerating decarbonization and our resilience. There are technologies where we do have comparative advantages, so we need to build on them. Now, there is still, I think, a sense of a more horizontal approach that we want a little bit of everything, and that is not going to work. So I think that's another item where we might want to redirect our efforts. And I think that's very important to bear in mind, that is not only comparative advantages within Europe, but also internationally. She made a strong statement today concerning Made in Europe provisions to come up when it comes to clean tech. If you look at the clean industrial deal communication, Made in Europe as such was not really mentioned. It was resilience and sustainability criteria. So we are now taking a step further in towards a more, I want to, let's say, protectionist flavor, if you want to put it that way, which I think is risky, right? Because we should not close our borders, we should not close our market and just try to do everything here. This is not going to work. We need to be open, but smartly open, in order to build also the new clean supply chains with third countries, building partnerships, the clean trade and investment partnerships that still need to be developed, because that's the only way also to the risk from the Chinese predominant suppliers, and also, I would say, from the wider geopolitical tensions we are having also with the United States.
We got a question along those lines about industrial policy and the use of public funds, particularly in semiconductors and deep tech. How can we use the EU money? How can we prevent subsidy races in the member states? What do you think?
Yeah, she mentions also that our strategy to catch up in that area here, and that was very much focused on we need to build large infrastructure, big plants, access to infrastructure. This is, of course, important that we have access to infrastructure, but it's really important to have access to the best infrastructure possible here. And again, trying to make sure that we have enough access to private privately invested large infrastructure, that there are enough incentives for that to do here. What I think is really important is that we do have enough entrepreneurs that are willing to use these kind of technologies to develop their own specific new ideas on which they can build comparative advantages here. And there, I think it's much more than just building infrastructure. And what is very important is having access to the best possible technologies available here, but then using that in your own applications where you can build comparative advantages here. And that means a much more general policy in terms of making sure we have a good functioning single market here that allows these incentives to take place here. So not so much focus on, okay, we need big money, big investments here. Really thinking much more carefully about where can we unleash private incentives in this area.
Thank you. We got a question about financial integration. What can the EU do there? It was certainly not part of her agenda today. We at Bruegel, and I include my colleague Nicolas Véran, have written quite extensively about the benefits of a common EU capital market supervisor to replace national supervisors. Mm-hmm. And this is something that really can create conditions for cross-border investment because it will make it more clear what happens when things go wrong and who's minding the store. So would refer you to that. And on the banking side, we have a real test right now to see whether cross-border mergers will stop taking place now that we do have cross-border supervision for the big banks in Europe. So those would be the two things I'd mentioned there. This leads us to a couple of questions we got about the structure of the EU itself and some of the themes she mentioned. Will she be able to convince the member states to reconsider things like unanimity, maybe to consider a treaty change of some sort? She mentioned perhaps giving the parliament a right of initiative. And people who are listening, thank you very much for your questions, are wondering, does she have the support? Can any of that actually happen? Simone?
Well, I think that's the big institutional question we have been facing for a long time, right? I mean, governing 27 member states with unanimity becomes clearly almost impossible in view of taking difficult and important decisions we have to take. So moving to qualified majority in different areas, including foreign policy, becomes unavoidable if you want to be up to the challenges of our time. Now, the question there goes back to the member states and whether countries are willing to basically support more concessions and ceding part of their sovereignty to the EU level. And that's where I think we still have a major bottleneck. And we see the Council slowing down many fights that are way less political than this. So at the moment, honestly, I see it very difficult to move forward with any meaningful internal reform, given the very difficult political circumstances we are seeing in very different member states.
So I think what the EU should be doing is to be much more smart on this, in the sense that really trying to identify where is it really important that we go for unanimity, where we really need standardization, harmonization, but where can we also go already a long way by having qualified majority. And I'm thinking of the 28 regime here, because there you could say, okay, we need one harmonized regime for all countries here. That will be require unanimity, will be very difficult to deal with. But I think if we would actually phrase it more like we will introduce the 28 regime as an option, an option that is really there to unleash the barriers that scale-up companies would be facing, and only for those companies. And we try to design it in a carefully enough way that this is an option that becomes attractive for those companies particularly. Then it is only an option next to other companies that would don't want to scale up here. And then we could actually go already quite a long way by without unanimity here. And enough incites competition among this optional versus the others here to really incite the changes that we would need here. So I think we need to think way more carefully when we when we actually need which kind of instruments here, rather than going in general, we would need harmonization or not, but really trying to see, be more smart in terms of what do we actually need in order to address what kind of bottlenecks that we are critically facing.
So I agree with Reinhilde that we can be better, do better even without unanimity or within the current framework, legal framework. But I do think we need to get away from unanimity on, particularly on tax policy, which is incredibly difficult. So I'm grateful that she put this into her speech. And maybe the only thing that gives me a bit pause is that she put it into, if you like, the generic bits of her speech, right? So she had a very strong but generic beginning. She had a strong generic ending. She didn't put it with a nitty-gritty. She put it as sort of the rousing end of her speech, which means it stayed at the level of a general appeal rather than the level of a policy initiative. So if you are mean, and I do not want to be mean to her, but today particularly, you could say this was cheap talk, but it's certainly better that she said it than that she didn't say it. It would have been, the speech would have been internally inconsistent if she had not said that. She could have, if she had been more serious about actually fighting over it, she could have given it greater concreteness and handled it in a different context.
Chairman, earlier you mentioned the capitulation of the trade deal that was struck in Scotland. We have a question. Do we think this tariff war may hamper the EU's growth? And I would tack on to that, do you think she is trying to avoid the total chaos that she said would have come had she not struck that deal?
So, I think that green growth in the EU is basically, of course, hurt by the change in administration in the US, but not so much because of the tariffs, but rather because the fact that the United States not only is no longer pursuing meaningful domestic climate policies or indeed international climate policies, but is actively undermining both domestic and international climate transition, sheds doubt on the inevitability of the energy and climate transition and the whole development of the green industrial revolution is predicated on that inevitability. So the U.S. is torpedoing an anchor of expectations, driving investment, okay, at the global level. Now, I don't think the U.S. is strong enough to actually have that effect. And, you know, the Chinese are not torpedoing that. So it will continue, but it makes it harder. And, of course, it has a direct effect on clean tech exports to the U.S. Now, there's a countervailing effect, which is the U.S. is also dropping out as a competitor. Now, as someone who believes very strongly in climate, for me, the fact that the U.S. took green industrialization seriously was good news rather than bad news, even though it puts us as Europeans in a more difficult position. So I'd rather have that than not have that. But one could say that this is, silver lining from an industrial EU national strategy perspective that at this point the US has effectively left the field to us and to the Chinese and a few emerging markets, and they are out there. But on the whole, I do think this is bad for green industrialization, even in the EU.
Simona and Reinhilde, any thoughts on supply chains and the EU's effort to build other trade allowances, like with Mercosur or other places around the world, to both encourage trade and growth and also keep these clean tech supply chains going and diversified?
Yeah, I think it was honestly also a bit of a pity that she didn't really stress the external dimension of the Clean Industrial Deal, because by the end of the year, we will see the first clean trade and investment partnership being launched with South Africa. There will be others following next year. And I think this external dimension is really important to develop a serious industrial policy agenda in this space in Europe as well. And I think this will also, to be serious, have to open difficult questions such as, do we want to go, for example, made in Europe in our procurement rules? Or do we instead want to have resilience and sustainability criteria in Europe when it comes to public procurement, for example, that can also be open to those countries with which we are developing these clean trade and investment partnerships, so to have a more open approach to resilience and sustainability. So I think she mentioned the idea also of trying to use instruments like the Global Gateway in order to promote Made in Europe adoption across third countries. Another element where I think more action will have to be undertaken moving forward.
Yeah, if you look at it from the perspective of innovation and for really developing value chains for new technologies, innovation is all about open and global, keeping this open. Otherwise, you'll never be at the frontier. So I think it's really important that we make sure that we keep this open and have to be really balancing very carefully what we can do internally. And having, of course, a strong internal market is already one dimension of openness, but really have to be open at the global level here. But being a strong partner so that we can really benefit from that openness as well. So technological sovereignty for me is all about keeping it open so that we can work with the best partners that are available internationally here so they can really be at the frontier. So it's finding that balance in terms of openness versus own strengths here, but that's a combination that has to be open.
So what about defense? She talked about more common defense approach. She talked about more EU evaluation with this possible defense semester. German, you and some Bruegel co-authors have had some pretty strong proposals on what the EU can do about this. What do you make of her speech, and how do you put that in the context of what you think needs to be done?
So I thought this was one of the weaker parts of her speech on substance. So I like what she said about Ukraine. If you look at, you know, what was there concretely, there was a reference to cooperation with Ukraine on drones, where she put some money on the line. There was a reference to an Eastern Flank initiative, which I think is alluded to the fact that the U.S. has been withdrawing from this. So I like that too, because it substituted in a sense it is was symbolic of our willingness to step up. Where she was really weak, I thought, was on the governance of defense and particularly procurement within the EU, where this was either just repeating the obvious point that we have to do more together on procurement without telling us to get there, how to get there, and or it was about celebrating the success of you know, what was a, you know, given that they had to improvise, was not a bad initiative, safe, a lending-based initiative, but not really telling us what the next step is, right? So here, this is one of these areas where you think, look, this is not really part of the inertia of the overall program that comes out of the Draghi report, because the Draghi didn't cover defense, right? So, and they have been improvising on that since the infamous Munich summit speech of Vice President Vance. And, you know, they came up with some small but creative things, and you would not have expected something more substantive. And you know, in all modesty, we did at Bruegel generate a few big ideas on this. And the main big idea is that you have to create a genuine defense single market where you have competition across the entire EU and you get away from home bias. You know, we all have our little defense industrial nationalisms within Europe, and it's ridiculous because
It prevents competition across the EU. It leads to small production numbers and high unit costs. It prevents scale. So that's the number one priority. And then the number two priority, I think, is to invest more in common European defense assets that are cross-border, that to some extent can substitute for what the US is providing now. So she made the generic point that Europe has to step up in its own defense. She didn't tell us. And this means that, you know, we do need to have our own satellite intelligence apparatus, our own Europe-wide air defense system. Now, why did she not do that? I think perhaps this is one of the areas where she didn't want to upset the Americans. This one possibility. The other possibility is that, you know, it is not an EU competency, a commission competency. And so maybe she was a little shy to step out of her role. But come on, she's a European leader. She's not just the Commission president in a narrow sense. So I think she could have called for something that goes beyond the EU, that includes the UK, Norway, and maybe even requires some sort of intergovernmental thing, because our treaties may not carry us enough. So what she lacked there, I think, was sort of the vision to step out of the realm of the familiar. And so I think she could have done better on that.
So again, from my innovation angle, what I was a bit missing in the whole defense discussion is a bit more this longer term vision of where we want to build up those capacities to really deliver in terms of military infrastructure here. And then I think certainly if we think of the next generation of technologies and products that we would be using here, there is, I think, way more room to really think of an EU level of integration here, because that's still longer term and that's R&D. So that's still much closer to EU competences here. And particularly also the dual use of those technologies here, and particularly also with digital and AI here. So what I'm still missing a bit is in defense, how we are actually going to build on the next generation of technologies, dual use technologies that will allow us to build that capacity. And for that, I think the case to be doing that at the EU scale is way more easier to be made here. But I'm missing that a little bit in the whole discussion today.
We were talking just before the podcast about whether her role is to implement what the member states are willing to support or to drag the member states forward. And that seems like something that she's still wrestling with. Simona, what about energy independence? She talked about wanting to phase out Russian fossil fuels. What about other fossil fuels?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because honestly, I found the energy part of the speech just a bit underwhelming, in the sense that she said Europe is on the path to energy independence, as you say. But I think this is quite a long path still that we need to walk ahead, right? By the way, yeah, it is also, at least to the citizens out there, to all of us, difficult to square this point about energy independence and the what we have in the EU-US trade deal, where we have this commitment of buying 700 billion euro in US LNG, oil and nuclear fuel by the end of 2028. So if you look at that number, and if you think about the possibility of replacing, for example, no, Russian LNG with American LNG, that would brought the share of American in total EU LNG imports from the current 55% to around 70%, which is not only against independence, but really against diversification. Now, better the Americans than the Russians, for sure. And we need to phase out Russian fossil fuels, as she said, quicker possibly than previously scheduled. But that needs to happen in a more diversified manner as well. On energy, she was, in my view, not particularly convincing in the speech, because she put forward this idea of the energy highways, so 8 corridors where Europe will try to push basically interconnections, working with the governments. Now, excellent, but still difficult for me to understand what's different from the good old projects of common interest that we have always had there, and that never really delivered, I mean, all the time, right? I mean, some were successful, many others were not because of political resistances in member states. So difficult to see the added value of these new initiatives, but happy to see what is boiling in the pot there as we move forward. And finally, I was a bit disappointed by the fact that there was no strong reference made to the integration of the electricity market. No? So the idea of developing an electricity union for competitiveness, which is really also at the core of the Draghi report, was simply not taken up. And what we have seen over the last year is that, as mentioned at the beginning, there has been very little progress. And also when it comes to the governance of our energy union, we have only seen very timid steps in view of having little enhancement to the technical collaboration, but not certainly the big step forward when it comes to the political support you need for a real energy union development. So I think that was a bit of a missed opportunity in the speech.
Yeah, I think it's a very good example of where we could actually deal with quite a lot of clear KPIs on where do we want to land with this energy security here, and then committing and that we monitor and evaluate how good we are in terms of getting to some clear-cut results as well.
We had that question earlier about one or two tough but really effective productivity reforms, and a unified European electricity grid would certainly be up there. And listeners, I would direct you to writing by Simone and our colleagues Ben McWilliams and Georg Zachman on how we could do this and ways to get there from where we are now. It's a really great topic. We are closing in last 10 minutes of our podcast. If there are any other questions out there, State of Union is the Slido code. We have gotten a couple of questions, not just on how to bring the member states around, but how to bring the voters in the member states around. Do any of you think that von der Leyen was speaking to individual Eurosceptic voters, or was this really a speech within people, to people who are already within the policy sphere, like sitting members of the European Parliament, like national government stakeholders? Who are we talking to?
So the first graph that actually was in her speech actually showed that there is still quite a lot of good support for the EU level here. So I also don't want to be too much of a scaremonger here. I think there is quite a lot of still goodwill that we can build on here. And maybe also a bit more directly this goodwill rather than through the member states here, I think, as well. Because it's all comparative to what voters' confidence still have in at the national levels here. So I think we should also at the EU level make sure that we are actually talking directly also to the voters and showing them what at the EU level we are doing as a comparative advantage to national, and not doing it through the national levels so much.
Oh, in my view, the first part of the speech was very powerful, and I expect that part of the speech to go down to the national media extremely well. The idea that Europe is in a fight and we need to scale up our game to face the big bad guys out there, I think it's a quite clear and straightforward message. Now, the fact that this might be the case is an additional responsibility on the delivery side, because if we keep in Brussels or in Strasbourg, you know, putting forward the right words, the right slogans, but then fail on the delivery, that's exactly where you generate the skepticism about the European integration process, right? So I think delivery should really come now on many of these things we have been discussing here, because otherwise this will backfire.
Yeah, so I also would give quite a lot of credit. And, you know, I also recognize that she gets that credit partly because she didn't follow our advice and wasn't particularly nuanced on trade-offs and unintended consequences and all those things that the wonks would have wanted more, right? So I think there was two things that were very good in the address in terms of, you know, as the questioner says, changing the minds of citizens who find themselves being drawn to Eurosceptic parties. One is that she very much emphasized that we are all in this together and the future of Europe is at stake. And the remarkable thing about the reaction
to her speech from across the political spectrum is that everyone from the far right to the far left and the center thought that we were humiliated in Scotland by the US. I think that's the only point that all parties agreed on. And so the fact that we as Europeans are being disrespected in a sense, and that the fundamental basis for our prosperity is in question, I think that's a widely shared point, and she, I think, effectively utilized this very well. I mean, the other thing one has to give her credit for is the fact that she a lot about the speech was about affordability. Now, some of this was about repackaging things like energy union that you can argue for from different perspectives, autonomy, efficiency, growth as an affordability issue. Also, the main thing that she said about the car industry was about affordability through the e-cars. But the housing point was new and good. And so I do think this was as good a speech as she could have done on that front.
One of the reasons that people give for why the deal in Scotland was so much weighted towards what the U.S. wanted is, of course, the war in Ukraine and U.S. support, or at least U.S. lack of non-support, explicit non-support for European efforts to support Ukraine. The strong opening part of her speech focused on that, focused on the connections there. In the last 5 minutes that we have, do you each want to say something about the economic dimension of this very serious foreign policy complex in Ukraine, the situation that we have, and where we go from here?
Yeah, I think it's all related, again, to the power that you can have in these kind of cases really comes from having a combination of economic and military power here. And for that, it's still, I think we need to also think way more proactively in the longer term how we can build up that strength that we currently don't have by making sure that we invest in the capacity for next generation economic and military power so that we can play a much stronger and more credible role at geopolitical level. Otherwise, I don't see any other other solution here. And I think we can do that, but it requires really a very clear policy towards that direction.
Well, I think she had very strong words on Ukraine as well as on Moldova, the Western Balkans, and the prospect of integrating them all, and how important it is to have this new round of European reunification. So I think that showed a very important vision for the future. I think that the process of getting there will hopefully, through the expansion of our acquis communautaire, bring immediate benefits to these people when it comes to the development of their own market. Because there was one of the MEPs in the debate said we should not only behave as a market, but as a power, right? But in reality, being a strong market and making a good use of that is also, I think, a source of power. And therefore, we'll need to make the best of that. Huh?
It's the only source of power, I think.
I would say.
Yeah, I think she made the point, which I would put like this. The defense of Ukraine is existential for the EU, not just because Ukraine is in effect a buffer between us and direct Russian aggression, but because the future integration of Ukraine, both in our military cooperation, but also in the single market, is a cure, a potential cure to some of the biggest weaknesses in the EU, which is that we are slow and expensive, that we have a demographic problem. And, you know, these are the sorts of things, dynamism, that is often, particularly in the United States, has been overcome through immigration, through openness. So the ability of the United States to rejuvenate itself is very largely driven on this fact that it's been a magnet for people from all over the world. Now, the U.S. has taken completely the opposite approach, and we in the EU have a very ambivalent attitude on immigration. So we say yes to, you know, scientists coming, but we are extremely worried about uncontrolled migration across the Mediterranean. And she made both points. And so in some sense, to have a young country, a techie country, a country that has shown its resilience and creativity before Russian aggression, be a member of the EU is just a great way to you know, make this EU a more flexible, forward-looking, and also, by the way, in a military sense, a more weighty power. She didn't state it quite the way I stated it now, but I think what she said was essentially consistent with that view.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to a live edition of The Sound of Economics, which will also be available later on all of your favorite podcast platforms. So thank you to those of you joining us live. Thank you to those of you listening to us later. Our speakers today have been Bruegel's director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, and senior fellows Reinhilde Wöhlers and Simone Tagliapietra. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You will see research in the show notes on these topics from these authors you've been listening to today. And I can't thank all of you enough for speaking and all of you enough for listening. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.